Sydney Pickett, Reel 1. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? For example, when were you born and where?
September 23rd, 1925. I was born in Ilford, Essex, part of Greater London. So, what else? I'm trying to get it working.
Tell me a bit about your family. Were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
No, I was the oldest boy, and I have two sisters. My mother was a tailoress. My father was a fishmonger. He was in the First World War. Oddly enough, so Dad in the Arabian, where they are now, Mesopotamia it was called. So having been born and lived in Chagwell Heath, Ilford, normal schooling, infants and all that sort of thing, missed the 11 plus because I had measles. What else happened? Yes, so I went to a normal conventional school. At 14, the war broke out and I was evacuated to Somerset. nothing exciting there, except I suppose as an evacuee, I was fortunate that my mother was a organizer or whatever, so she knew a bit more about what was happening. But we went to Paddington and got on a train to the West Country. We didn't know where we were going. It was quite a long journey and we got diversions and things. We left fairly early in the morning. At night, we were still not low. In the early evening, we didn't know where we were. We were coming down through Weston-super-Mare. Eventually, we were put off at Weston-super-Mare and we were herded up in groups on the street to walk around the town residential part, with the organiser saying, "Anyone for two boys? Anyone for a girl and a boy? Anyone for a mother with two children?" All this sort of, it's quite amazing, really, amusing. You're being sort of flogged off, as it were. That does stick in the mind. So anyway, we were there for about 3 weeks. We clashed with another school, and eventually they got the, we were just grammar school, because I did go to the South East Essex Technical College, which was, 11 plus exam passed it. Anyway, we then moved to a town called Street in Somerset.
Who did you stay with during your evacuation?
Local people. I obviously was quite good friends with the family. I stayed with them for quite some time. Eventually, my family moved down to Street and they rented a stone cottage, and my father worked down there. And they were down there, they finished up living down there like forever in Street. That was 14.
What did you do when you were down there?
Well, we shared a grammar school, like half day each and then the other half day for sports or whatever it was. My parents didn't think I was getting anywhere and it was a waste of time, so they said I should leave and take a job. 14 wasn't a wrong time. Most people have left school at 14 and went to work anyway, so there was nothing wrong with that. I went into Clark's, which is the local factory down there. They made shoes, still do. I went in as a general worker to start with, and after a short period, they took me out and put me in the office. So I was an office boy. We had two office boys. There was further education. Clerks were Quakers and they were very good at this sort of thing. We had at half day at school and half day at work alternately. So for every job, there were two boys and switched over. Unfortunately, when in the classroom, I was way ahead of them, and there was nothing, you know, I could have told the teacher things, I think. You know, I was just, so they put me into the ARP telephone exchange, and I was down there and manned that when we were supposed to be at class.
Which school were the clerks employees taught at?
It was called Strode Technical College, I believe it was called. Strode, anyway.
And what sort of classes were they given?
Well, continuation classes beyond what they did in a local local education, ordinary education. Naturally, the obvious thing was that the education in London was far superior and advanced to the education in the country.
How did you adapt to country life, and what was country life like during the war?
Well, I only had 2 years of it, I suppose, and I went to work in parks, as I said, and I became the office boy and everything else, so I was working. I was also in the ARP as a messenger, which not only happened during the school time, it happened at night. I did watches as well at 14.
Tell me about the ARP. What was that?
Air raid precautions. They had air raid wardens that we had steel hats and all that. I was a messenger, so I had my steel hat and I had a bike. And if there was any breakdown in communications, I'd have to take messages from the headquarters, which was on the top of, well, we were on the top of a tower at Clark's, sort of fire watching and all that sort of thing. And I had a good part of my education there. The men, there was only one boy, as it were, as a messenger. They taught me to pay Ponto and Bragg and all the other that was quite interesting, you know, at night. So, well, we had that. We never had any bombs, that's one thing, fortunately. There was one fell in a field, a stray one, but we went through all the routine, obviously, of being up and awake and looking for fires. We could see the fires at Bristol and Bath from where we were, because they were heavily bombed, like everywhere else was. So that was Clark's until I was 16.
So after you, your parents do anything of similar nature during the war? For example, you mentioned your mother was involved in organising evacuation of children to London.
No, because she had my two sisters. One of them was quite a young baby. Oh yes, because she was a tailoress. She did alterations at home for a local tailor. Yes, during the war, my father, the only work he could get was like quarrying. He worked in the stone quarry.
So did he give up? Did he have a shop in London?
No, he was what they called a first hand, you know, salesman, fishmonger, I suppose he was. No, he just came down and got any job he could, and that's what he got. But didn't do him any harm. He was quite tough. Incidentally, now I'm doing the same thing out in my garden with heavy work and all that. But that's nearly another digression. Returning to Clark's and Somerset, as I say, I had 2 years there, and when I was 16. I decided I wanted to join the forces because all my local friends were joining up. They were generally 18. So I joined the Navy because at that time you could only join boy service at 16 with the Navy. You couldn't do it in the Army or Air Force. I'm not sure about the Air Force. Anyway, you couldn't do it in the Army. So that's why I joined the Navy as far as anything else. I think that closes the Somerset thing, except I got involved with Clark's again at a much later stage when I was 30, but we jumped to that in a minute. Joined the Navy as a boy.
Did you have any ambition to join the Navy beforehand?
Not that I can recall, not specifically, no, it's just the war. And I think, you know, you, when you're 16, it's exciting. So we went to the Isle of Man, HMS St George.
How did you apply to become a member of the Royal Navy?
I went to the recruitment office in Bristol.
And were you required to do any tests?
Oh yes, yes, you did do a sort of general broad education test, you know, so nothing exciting, quite easy, obviously.
Were you able to express any interest in any specialisation at that stage?
You were invited to apply for either general seamanship service or communications. Once I'd been interviewed by the petty officer, he said, well, you better go into communications, because communications was required a higher standard of education than general seamanship, just so happens.
And by that stage, what level of education had you acquired?
Well, I left school at 14, didn't I? So I, and like with the, so I was there from September to the January, about 3 months, so I didn't do much more over that. So I had what was like the first two, 3 years of a grammar school type of education, but it was...
Well, so we're talking about your education, level of education.
Yes.
Did this have the equivalent of 2 years?
Well, 3 years, sort of, well, what's the word on the secondary education, with the South East Essex Technical College, which was one of the first technical colleges in the country. It had equal standing with a grammar school.
So the recruiter suggested signals, because you obviously did very well in the test.
Mm.
And how did you feel about that?
Oh, quite happy, I suppose. I mean, well, I'd had 2 years in Somerset where I was... what's the word, say, superior to the local lads and all this, that and the other, because I was working with them in the factory, so they were my peers, as it were. I was, well, generally more educated, I suppose. Well, I was. So I was glad. So I went to, I went to Bristol, joined the Navy, called up there in 1941 when I was 16.
You went to the Isle of Man.
What
happened to Bristol before you went to the Isle of Man?
Basically medical test and general interview and discussion with the recruiting petty officer or chief petty officer as to how suited I would be to what. And there was no doubt that he said I should go into communications, which I did. I was quite happy with that. As it happened, I had made some notes, but I forgot this one. While I was at the Strode School, you know, dual school work, I joined the Air Force Cadets, and we had all that business with parade things. So we fired rain guns and other things, and we had a lot of that as well. So that was interesting. How did we come there? Anyway, so when I joined up, I was a communicator. The first 12 weeks, you were just communications generally.
Can you tell me about your arrival at the Isle of Man, or on the Isle of Man? What happened as you arrived at your first
real
contact?
Well, we all met in Bristol and got on the train. It was probably about 20 of us or something like that. We went up to Fleetwood and we got on a ferry from Fleetwood to Douglas. It was very rough. It was October, I think it was. Anyway, it was very rough. And most of the kids were sick all over the place. I fortunately fought it, and because I had to, it was me. So I wasn't sick. But then we had to march from the dock up to the Cunningham's holiday camp, which was all huts for holiday camp. We were allocated huts. We were three to a hut. So that was part of it. The actual course...
Can I ask you, before we move on to the course, can I ask you a bit about the issue of your uniform? When were you issued with the uniform?
Within probably a day, two or three days. And because as boys, we were regular, you know, servicemen, you know, we weren't HOs or hostilities only. And we took on, as it were, the same training as it happened for years and years at Shotley and Ganges. However, we had to stamp all our clothing. We had a wooden stamp with a sort of SC picket on it, stamp, which all your clothes were stamped. And then you had to embroider your name, change stitch. Can you imagine that? A lot of what we call Harry, what's it, Matlow, is all doing. So we had to, in our new entry period, we had to do all that.
What kit were you issued?
Full naval sailor's uniform, you know, the collar, hat, jumper, everything you know would want. So we everything was marked except needles in our sewing kit, because you couldn't really mark a needle, but that was the way it went. And we had kit inspections where we had to roll all our kit up into a certain size and lay it all in line. I used to have photos of this, you know, with your name there. It was all very meticulous.
And how often were those inspections?
At least once a term, say something like three times a year, but sometimes intermediate as well.
What would happen if your kit wasn't up to scratch?
Well, you'd get punishment. Sort of.
What sort of things?
Well, punishment, I forget what they used to call it now, 3A, 8A or something. You'd run around the parade ground with a rifle going backwards and forwards or holding it above your head, and the parade ground was on a slight slope, so you didn't mind running down, but when you run back and you was all in your boots and gaiters, and I think sometimes we had a pack as well, I can't remember. I had a couple of goes at it, been punished.
What for?
I can't remember. All sorts of things you got punished for.
What were the living conditions like during your training? You mentioned, for example, that you were allocated to holiday home huts.
Well, I mean, we had the normal service rations, just basic. They had all the facilities, obviously, at a holiday camp for cooking, but they didn't sort of marry up with a holiday camp cuisine.
What about the sleeping arrangements?
Pardon?
What about the sleeping arrangements?
Well, in the house we had bunk beds, like one, two, three beds in each hut. I don't know whether this might be interest, if not stop me. My mother, we're talking about smoking. My mother said to me when I was 14 or whenever it was, she said, "You're not smoking yet, are you?" I said, "No." But we had experimented with these. You've got two woodbines, or one woodbine and two matches or something for a penny or some stupid thing like that. And we used to take them off before the war. Anyway, I said, "No." So she said, "Well, look, I'd sooner you did smoke rather than go and do it behind my back." So I said, "I don't want to smoke. It's not good. I don't know why I didn't want to smoke." I said, "No, I don't want to smoke." She said, "Well, you can do it, and you can do it in the house because everybody smoked then." I said, "No, I don't want to smoke." So that was good. Was I a good boy? I go to the Navy and they said, "You can't smoke. You're not allowed. Not until you're 18. I didn't like that either. So I did start smoking, as all the boys did, but you weren't allowed. But when you went ashore, you know, shore leave, you smoked. Now, I suppose this was the beginning. No, remind me to go back in a minute before the war. Or shall I go back now?
If it's relevant to what you're talking about.
It is, actually. I find it interesting now, thinking about it. Before the war, during sort of 1938, in the big park near us, they had the territorials encamped. And when they moved in, we used to go out to the fencing and they'd ask you to go and get us a pack of cigarettes, go and buy some chewing gum and all that. And the boys were all crowding around there and all that. So I had a word with the local shop news agents. I said, if I can get into the camp, will you back me up and give me the supplies and I'll start a little unit? So this guy said, yeah, you can't do that. So I did. I went in there, I saw the sergeant on the gate and I told him, I said, look, this is silly, all this business. He said, why don't I just come in with a whole bank full of... Cut the story short, I had a pram, you know, like the old-fashioned prams, filled it up with cigarettes, chocolate, daily papers, everything, a lot. It wasn't far away, wheeled it up to the park in through the morning, laid it all out on the grass and, you know, cut everyone else out. I was like that. I suppose I was budding entrepreneur. So how did we get that? Because we're talking about smoking. So yes, coming back on smoking. So I decided that it was going on, but not very prevalent. I started dealing in cigarettes. So when we had this shore leave, which was from about 4 to 6 or something like that, you know, not late. I'd buy cigarettes and tie them up in what we called a neckerchief, any of that, and throw them over this high hedge that surrounded part of the camp. And then at night, in the middle of the night, I'd creep out of the hut, go up through pigsties to the other side, where hopefully I'd find my big, and I did, never lost one. And bring them back, and we'd sell, I think, Woodbines were tuppence each, and Players were threepence each. You know, it was quite a profit. And then we didn't have any matches and things like that quite often. So what we used to do, take the light bulb out, have a lead pencil and put boot polish blacking on it and the needle and the other thing, put them up to the electric connection and the sparks would set the boot polish alight on the end of the pencil, and that was our means of ignition. Sometimes we'd fuse the lights and because the instructions knew what was going on, they'd come down and search and all that. But I was very lucky, I got away with murder. I didn't get rich, but I wasn't very poor. So that was another thing, which was a bit off course, I suppose. I don't let that go back to the Navy, they might punish me.
He's probably a bit late for that.
Anyway, so that was that. Where were we going? That was at the camp.
Can I ask you about the training you received itself? I mean, the basic parade ground training, the real basic stuff, and then perhaps any specialist communications and training you received.
Well, the first thing, we had to do a full naval induction course, which included seamanship, sailing, sports, general education, which included electrics and magnetics and or physics, I suppose. So that was a further education, obviously. And if on the edge, there were two fields. There was, you know, your naval thing, and then there was the education thing. And you took your exams, and I passed all the education things, and that was that.
Tell me about the seamanship.
Well, you learnt obviously knots. You learnt to row and sail a boat. You learnt about the history of the Navy. You learnt about the terminology of this, that and the other and all that. You learned about anchors and all the parts of a ship. Didn't learn anything about the stokers, like the engineering, that the stokers used to do that. They were not anything to do with us and we didn't have anything to do with them. It was one of those things to start off with anyway. Never went away. I suppose we had a thorough grounding in seamanship anyway. And then, of course, we had a concentrated, a long-term learning about signals. Signals include, the first 12 weeks of communications, you're all together. In the communication branch, there's the signals and the wireless telegraphy. So they can become two separate branches. It's traditional that if your education's good, you go into the wireless telegraphy because it requires a higher level, you know, to learn about wireless and all of that and the other. Because they used to learn technical as well in those days, you know. So I was going to be a telegraphist. One day I was down in the harbour and we was communicating by signal light from the harbour up to the tower at the camp. And it was raining and sort of miserable, and I don't know why to this day, but I was sitting and suddenly I thought, well, I don't know, I think I'd sooner be out in the open like this and doing this than I would stuck in an office at the bows of a ship. I don't want to be wireless telegrapher. So we were near the end of our 12-week course, so I told the instructor, I said, you know, why? I said, oh God, he said, the chief told one off, but you know what, he was sort of quite chuffed with you. He told him anyway, and they tried to get me, and I had to see the signal officer as well. He said, no, you should be a telegraphist. I don't want them. I made my mind up, really, and I stuck to it. They couldn't do anything about it, so I became a signalman instead.
What does that job involve?
Signalman? Well, you communicate with, it's called a visual signal, basically, everything's visual, telescopes, binoculars, whatever. You obviously learn the Morse code, and you signal in Morse code with flashing lights. So we have what we call Aldis lamps, where you go like this, you've probably seen them in pictures. We have 10-inch lamps, where you have a handle and go like that, and then we have 20-inch lamps, where you go like that. All in Morse code, lights. You have flags that are hoisted up the mast. You've seen probably flags hoisted up to the yard arms, A, B, C, D, whatever it might be. And there are endless codes and signal books and combinations of all the different flags, which include the full alphabet, full set of numerals, and about 20-odd special flags that have special meanings, and all these are stuck in lockers, and you hook them up and send signals to the fleet. Again, it's visual. We also do semaphore, you know, semaphore,
yeah.
You know it, yeah?
Yeah,
yeah.
But unfortunately the mic won't pick up for our movement, so could you just...
Oh, sorry, semaphore, you have two small hand flags, about sort of 9 inches square on a piece of wood, and you put your arms in various positions related to the body. You could put, if you put your two arms out horizontally level with your shoulders and with the hands in that position, that in fact signifies letter R, and so if you drop the other one it's S, and so on and so on and so on. So that's the semaphore, which of course I'd already learnt in the Scouts.
The lights that you mentioned, were they operated on Morse code, I think you said?
No, just purely on the position of the arms. The lights were signalling Morse code, yes.
And they were operated by levers.
Yes, the light goes on and off in the two larger 10-inch and 20-inch things, and the levers are open and close shutters, so the light's going long and short exposures. The oldest lamp works as a mirror, as the bulb in a mirror, and the mirror reflects the light in the direction you're aiming at, again making pauses and different lengths of light to indicate the Morse code, dot 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 da, sort of business.
So that you were trained in all of those things?
Oh yes.
During your this period. What other training did you receive during your time on the Isle of Man?
Well, we did a lot of sport, of course. And we learned things like damage control, first aid, all sorts of general things. We didn't do anything like politics or things of that ilk. we didn't do an awful lot about grammar. By then you're supposed to have, you know, got where you would be anyway.
How did you cope with military life or Navy life?
How did I cope? I don't know. I coped. How did I cope?
For example, obviously if you're living in a camp, there's a certain lack of privacy.